Thanks for joining us. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Diane has a cold. She hopes to be back later this week. Federalism, the power-sharing relationship between the national and state governments, dates to the founding of the United States. That relationship has evolved over the years, and the continuing debate over what balance should be struck has helped fuel the emerging Tea Party movement. In part four of our series, The Constitution Today, we look at federalism. Joining me in the studio, Michael Quinn of the University of Virginia. He's executive director of James Madison's Montpelier. Nina Pillard of Georgetown University, and Stuart Taylor of Newsweek and National Journal. Welcome to the Diane Rehm Show.
Nice to be with you.
It's a pleasure to be here.
We invite our listeners to join our conversation later in this hour. You can call our toll-free number, 1-800-433-8850, or send us an email to drshow@wamu.org, or you can find us on Twitter or Facebook. Well, Michael Quinn, what was the framers' intent in devising the system of federalism?
Well, actually, it was one of the great creative inspirations of the founding, because what they came up with the idea that a people could be under the jurisdiction of two governments at the same time. And we're accustomed to that, but at the time that was introduced in the convention, and Madison was one of the proponents of it, it was brand new. And they wrestled with it at the convention.
Was there a model for it? Was there another place that had tried this kind of system before?
No. In fact, there was no model for it. And as more than one observer has said, if this idea had occurred to the British 10 years earlier, there would have been no need for the American Revolution. They would have found a way out. And Madison and the founders were dealing with much the same problem. The states were kind of a given. That's where the primary allegiance of every American lay. Although the idea of American nationhood and citizenship was emerging, but literally there was a consensus that there needed to be some union, that if you had disunion, you had disaster. But how to shape it was the big problem.
Nina, every high school social studies class talks about the Federalist Papers or refers to them. Give us a little brief refresher course on what they are, the Federalist Papers.
Well, the Federalist Papers were really an advocacy document, and they were op-ed pieces that were published in newspapers. So we're talking about journalism in its truest and original sense, and it was the effort of Madison, Hamilton, and John Jay to persuade the American people that this concept that the convention had created should be authorized and empowered by the people of America.
So when we talk about states' rights, Nina, what's the amendment or what part of the Constitution is the core of that?
Well, to some extent, Susan, the whole Constitution really reflects it because, as Michael said, the presumption at the time of the framing of the Constitution was that the states were the primary governmental organ for each individual, but we joined in a confederation with the national government, and the federal constitution created limited powers that it gave to the national government. So when I say the whole constitution really reflects the federalist design, the states have general governing powers. The national government has limited and enumerated governing powers. So every time the national government acts, the way of thinking it through is there power there in the Constitution? So the Commerce Clause, for example, gives the national government a pretty broad power to regulate national commerce. But there have been Supreme Court cases over the history of our nation that have sort of ebbed and flowed in how broadly they read that.
So, Stuart, go run through for us some of the powers that the federal government has.
Well, Nina mentioned the one that seems to come into play the most often in terms of the power of Congress to regulate interstate commerce. And upon that foundation has been built a gigantic edifice of congressional regulations, because just about all economic activity and some non-economic activity affects interstate commerce. But Congress, and that also is foreign commerce. Congress also has the power to raise and support armies, to levy taxes. The president has the power to as Commander-in-Chief of the Armed Forces. Congress has most other war powers, although the presidents over the centuries have seemed to invade that turf quite a bit. But it actually, the tension between the states and the federal government, we've been emphasizing so far the predominance of state powers and the federal being an add-on. But the whole reason for the Constitution, Michael can correct me if I'm wrong, the main reason for the Constitution was that the Articles of Confederation, which predated it, had given such small and limited powers to Congress that things didn't work. New York, for example, had a tax on imported firewood from Connecticut, and the colonies, the former colonies, were honeycombed with basically little warring economic policies, and a big part of the Constitution was to get past that and have one national market.
So the Constitution gave specific and more powers to the federal government, but reserved some powers exclusively to the states. What were those, Michael?
What was not delegated to the federal level was reserved either to the people or to the states. And it really was a change of mindset, because we were coming out of an era when sovereignty, power, resided with the monarch. And the intellectual concept of our founding was that sovereignty resides with the people. And in fact, if you follow that through, sovereignty doesn't reside at the state or at the federal government. A state does not have any rights. A state has powers that are delegated to it by the people, just as the federal government does. And what you really see at the convention, and I think in many cases since then, is still sort of wrestling and accepting that concept.
It's this 10th Amendment that you're referring to that says just flatly, the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution or prohibited by it to the states are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. Such a fundamental American concept.
Yeah. But I think the real key concept there is powers remain with the people. It's their right and authority to delegate them to the states or to the federal government. And as we've seen, as Stuart said, it seems like the federal edifice has grown. One could also say that that's a proper delegation from the people.
Nina.
One of the, for the sake of the listeners, because I know a lot of this sounds pretty abstract, there are areas that are sort of understood to be really principal areas of the states where the federal government has a very limited regulatory role. And family law is sort of the very core one. Education and criminal law are also considered to be really, the predominantly areas for the states, although we do have, some national law in education and certainly in criminal law. But it's worth bearing in mind that the vast bulk of laws that matter in the American people's everyday lives are state laws. The state really is the major font, and the state, the employees of the states are 10 times as many state government employees as there are national government employees today. So we still are talking about a much greater governmental presence at the state level.
Our phone lines are open. You can give us a call, 1-800-433-8850. Stuart.
I agree as a practical matter, but as a matter of constitutional power, there's been a long drift towards the federal government can do just about anything it wants, unless it's cut off by the provisions of the Bill of Rights. For many years, the 10th Amendment, when I took constitutional law 30-some years ago, the 10th Amendment was regarded as a dead letter because the powers of Congress had expanded so far, the thinking was that there were no powers left to be reserved to the states, at least. The embodiment of this might have been Elena Kagan's testimony last summer, before she was confirmed. A Republican senator asked her, well, suppose Congress passed a law saying you need to have, every American needs 3 servings of fruit and vegetables a day for the sake of the public health. Would that be constitutional? She said, well, that would be a dumb law. She didn't say it would be unconstitutional, because I think most liberals on the Supreme Court and a lot of moderates on the Supreme Court for many years have bought into the idea that the power to regulate interstate commerce is almost unlimited.
You said that when you were in law school, this seemed like a kind of dead letter. Has that changed today? Does it seem more? Is there more debate today than there was a few decades ago?
What changed it more than anything, I think, was a Supreme Court decision in 1995. Called United States versus Lopez. Congress had passed a law saying if you possess a gun within 1,000 feet of a school, there's a heavy federal penalty. And the Supreme Court held in that case and one other, now you've gone too far, Congress. You know, this has nothing to do with regulating interstate commerce, and therefore we're going to strike it down. But those two decisions, there's another one involving violence against women, and Nina can explain better than I imagine, those two decisions are kind of sitting out there all by themselves and have not generated a lot of follow-up decisions.
Nina.
I'd actually somewhat disagree about that, although I agree with Stuart. When I was in law school, we didn't really study the limits on national power. And I remember I was teaching constitutional law at the time when the Lopez decision came out, and someone said, well, at least it'll make constitutional law a lot more interesting. And we saw not just the Lopez decision, but in a series of decisions that were issued by the Supreme Court under the leadership of former Chief Justice William Rehnquist, we saw the court striking down provisions of national laws in a whole series of decisions, starting with the Lopez decision that Stuart mentioned, provisions of Americans with Disabilities Act, the Age Discrimination in Employment Act, the Violence Against Women Act, patent and trademark law, fair labor standards law. So there was a whole bunch of trimming that went on with the Supreme Court getting involved and saying, you know, there are limits on the commerce power, there are limits on, there are immunities of the states against regulation. And, you know, it really flows not just from the court, but from President Reagan. I mean, the what we call the Federalism Revolution was a really major part of the President Reagan's sort of program and his legacy.
And of course, we hear a lot about returning to the original ideas of the founders with the Tea Party movement. Many people with the Tea Party movement concerned about the expansion of the federal government. We're going to talk about that and more. First, we'll take a short break. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. And with me in the studio, Nina Pillard, professor of law at Georgetown University. Stuart Taylor, he's contributing editor at Newsweek and National Journal. And Michael Quinn, president and executive director of James Madison's Montpelier. We're talking about the system of federalism set up, part of our constitutional series on the Diane Rehm Show. Michael Quinn, the Constitution, of course, laid out the framework for how federalism was supposed to work. What were the early questions about it, the early disputes that had to be settled about how this system would work?
Well, Susan, it was the most contentious issue at the Constitutional Convention, and it really started with the opening when you had delegates announcing themselves and presenting their credentials. The delegates from Georgia said they were from the sovereign state of Georgia. So right there you had this whole concept of state and federal and how do you create a union. At heart, what they were really trying to figure out, though, there was a broad unanimity that you did not want disunion and that you had to change the Articles of Confederation or that's where you'd end up. The states were a political reality. And what Madison and the Found others realized is it could be turned into a strength, is have these intersecting powers, these intersecting governments overlaid over the same territory, the same people. And that could prove to be a check on power, governmental power, becoming tyrannical. How to figure it out? They didn't really come to a final solution. It was a discussion throughout the convention. It was the biggest issue they had to deal with. the Great Compromise that gave us state representation in the Senate and popular representation in the House, and a real intermixing. You know, we vote by state, even when we're voting for the president. So a real sort of jumble mixing, but they really felt that that complexity would help be a safeguard. And the issue of whether it struck the right balance was a major debate in the ratification debates and writings of the Federalist and the Anti-Federalist. It's still an issue with us today.
So after the nation was formed, the Constitution ratified, the government began, what were the early issues before the Supreme Court that related to the question of federalism and power sharing, Nina?
Well, there were a number of cases that dealt with the breadth of the commerce power, for example. Did Congress have authority to regulate the commerce between the several states? And you saw some early decisions that held that Congress didn't have the power, where what was at issue was more manufacture or agriculture, for example. If something involved conditions of manufacture, that would not be within the commerce power. Now, later, the court engaged in reinterpretation and said, well, how things are manufactured and, you know, the nature of agricultural regulation has an enormous impact on the national economy. So as the appreciation of kind of the commercial interdependence of the different sectors has grown, the judicial interpretations have recognized a generally greater national power. So we saw early on in a case called Wickard versus Filburn, which was a 1940 case under the Agricultural Adjustment Act, there was a question about whether production of wheat for home consumption by a farmer on the family farm could be regulated by Congress. And in a way, that's so quintessentially local, right? It's wheat that's not even going into commerce. It's nobody's buying and selling anything, and it's happening wholly within the state, even the locality. But Congress in that case, which was considered kind of a high water mark of congressional power, I'm sorry, the court in that case said Congress does have the power to regulate because that activity affects commerce. It's going to take away demand that would otherwise exist on the part of families like that to buy in interstate commerce. And so the appreciation of our economic interdependence has really fueled a much broader understanding of the Commerce Clause.
And, you know, a very current debate, the mandate that Congress has imposed on Americans to buy health insurance by 2014. Most Americans will be required to, or subject to penalties. And what's the basis for Congress's power to tell Americans that they have to buy health insurance, Stuart?
Congress claimed two bases, and it's being litigated in the courts now, and we'll probably go to the Supreme Court within the next couple of years. One was the power we've been talking about to regulate interstate commerce. The idea was that the health insurance market is certainly a huge interstate commerce affair, and that whether or not, and that in order to effectively regulate it, Congress thought they need to require everybody to have health insurance of some kind. And they justified that as a justified saying, i.e., that a 25-year-old healthy person has to go out and buy a certain kind of health insurance policy or pay a federal penalty. They justified that as regulating the interstate commerce. Now, I think one thing that's conceded, people argue about it, is that that's unprecedented. Congress has never, under the interstate commerce rubric, said you have to buy a certain kind of commercial product, and that's what gives rise to the kind of questions that were asked of Elena Kagan. What if they say we have to eat our vegetables, et cetera, et cetera? The other power they claimed that may be the sleeper here is the power to tax and spend. Although President Obama emphatically said this is not a tax, this mandate, and the penalty that would enforce it as a political matter, as a legal matter, the administration is defending it as an exercise of the taxing power, i.e., you don't really have to buy the health insurance. All you have to do is pay a fine, a tax, if you don't buy the health insurance. And those are the issues that are winding their way up through the courts.
Nina.
So one of the things I think that's important to keep in mind about the national health care approaches, national health care legislation, is that it leaves to the states lots of room to craft differing and innovative approaches on issues where uniformity isn't needed. So we've seen, you know, Medicaid itself, which this is, you know, an expansion of, is optional on the states. Any state that doesn't want to do it, doesn't have to do it. There's been, a ramp up in the federal funding that's going to be provided to the states. So it's the spending power that the federal government uses is very powerful, but it's basically saying we're going to give you a lot of money and, we're going to tell you some guidelines about how that money's spent. But we also want the states to perform this really salutary function that they have within the federal union, which is to be laboratories and see whether they can come up with differing ways to deal with this problem to the extent that that isn't going to create, gridlock and chaos in the national market. But there is a lot of flexibility in the states. And, I think you could point to healthcare legislation today as an example of a very strong federal-state partnership where there's a lot of discretion, but lots of regulatory flexibility on the states as well as the federal requirements.
Michael.
Well, the founders could never have imagined this kind of debate. The world was a much different world at that time. But what they were really striving to do was figure out a way to serve the public good. And I think that they would have felt that there are really useful distinctions between what the federal government does and what the state does. And as Nina's been saying, there's still a lot of latitude for the states. It really isn't a full federal takeover. And I think actually finding that balance as the world changes is a responsibility of every generation. The debate we're engaged in is a healthy debate in that respect because we're continuing to discuss how we live together. And that's what really the Constitution is all about, how do 300 million people live together, both free and at peace.
But the idea, the question of whether the Constitution is a document that should be followed very closely as it was written or evolved over time, that we've heard all that over and over again with recent Supreme Court nominations during the confirmation process.
Yeah.
Stuart, there's a real difference of opinion.
Sure. Well, it's getting more complicated. I mean, for many years, since Ed Meese kind of put originalism, as it's called, original intent, original meaning approach to the Constitution, into the center of national debate in the mid-1980s, conservatives have rallied around the idea that, yes, original meaning, the court shouldn't be making up new things, and liberals have rallied around the idea of the living Constitution. But now we're getting more and more liberals who are saying, hey, the original meaning helps us too, who are making arguments that say, fine, we'll argue original meaning against you conservatives, but we win. There was an interesting, kind of amusing moment in the Supreme Court a week or two ago in an argument over California's regulation of violent video games when Justice Samuel Alito said, I think he was joking a little bit, that his usual ally, Scalia, Justice Scalia wants to know what James Madison would have thought about violent video games. And that kind of encompasses, okay, if we're really going to go to original meaning, that's the level at which we'd kind of have to think about it because there are a lot of things that were not known then that have to be regulated under this language.
Well, Madison spent the rest of his life explaining to people what the Constitution meant. And he talked about it, and he even talked about the ambiguity in words and the imperfect ability to communicate means there will always be room for interpretation. And he also talked about, he was an undying moderate. He even talked about, you really need to find sort of the moderate sense of the words to get to the meaning of the Constitution.
Nina.
I think it's really important also in any discussion of states' rights and federal constitutional power and original meaning, not to lose sight of the very central role that race and in particular slavery has played in the history of this issue. So we have a federation of states, and there was early in our history enormous controversy, as our listeners know, about the institution of slavery. And one of the major sort of watershed moments in federalism was after the Civil War, the Constitution was amended, and the 13th and 14th and 15th Amendments, which outlawed slavery, created constitutional equality of all peoples, and gave the former slaves the right to vote. Those amendments were seen as kind of shifting a model toward federal power in order to ensure equality. It was the federal government that was going to have legislative power, and each of those amendments gave Congress new powers to carry out their promise. And so there's a kind of federal power model that then again was taken up in the 1950s and 60s and 70s with the national civil rights legislation, where those powers to assure equality were tapped into. And it was this, you know, a lot of the history of states' rights is a very ugly history of threats of secession, of actual secession, over resistance to the eradication of slavery and resistance to the civil rights movement. So there's a, you know, for a lot of Americans, the notion of states' rights is a notion that's very laden with some pretty sort of ugly overtones in our nation's history.
Well, and one of the principles founded, affirmed in the Civil War is that a state could not leave the Union, that its sovereignty did not extend that far. It was, the Union was unbreakable.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Well, Stuart, the Civil War, a period where the system of federalism evolved to some significant degree. Also, the New Deal era was a time when there was some rethinking of how exactly this balance would work. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, during the early New Deal, the Supreme Court was in the hands of the nine old men, as FDR called them. A majority of conservatives who struck down the majority of the early New Deal legislation, the National Industrial Recovery Act, I think, and a bunch of others. And they were sort of paralyzing a lot of efforts to deal with the Depression. And meanwhile, the Depression kept getting worse in spurts. And that was led to the court packing plan, which failed. But it sort of seemed FDR's war against the court, rhetorically at least, seemed to have an impact. And in 1937, in what's been called the switch in time that saved the nine, one justice started voting the other way, and they started upholding New Deal laws. And over time, they upheld just about everything. Nina earlier mentioned Wickard versus Filburn, which kind of extended to the level of a farmer growing wheat for home consumption. But I think, to build on what Nina was saying, between the effect of states' rights being thought of as something that perpetuated the Depression and states' rights being thought of as something that perpetuated the legacy of slavery, for a long time this country saying, I'm for states' rights was just not respectable, probably in any northeastern state or at any national university. And it's only been, I'd say, in the last 20 or 30 years or so that the debate over state versus federal power has a little bit returned to a debate that isn't hugely overshadowed by the race and depression history.
And some of that relates, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, at heart, I think one of the issues behind the sort of states' rights argument is that democracy works best if it's local. Keep your representatives in touch with their constituents. And that's an argument that goes back to the founding. I think that Madison and the founders, though, well, Madison in particular recognized that you can't always rely on the will of the majority to preserve liberty, that sometimes the majority can turn into a tyrant, whether it's the case of slavery or other issues, so that they recognized that you needed checks on that, and thus we have concepts of natural rights, higher law, and federalism itself.
I think I really agree with Michael that one of the sort of brilliant things about a federal system is that you do have governmental units that are closer to the people, and it's very hard for people to feel involved and feel like the whole nation is their community. But I wanted to point out another theme, which I think is, you know, one of the sources of resistance to the sort of Reagan and Justice Rehnquist, Chief Justice Rehnquist, federalism revolution, was that behind some of the efforts to narrow national power and devolve more power to the states was really not so much an desire to have the states be in the forefront of regulation, but to eliminate regulation, that there's an anti-government theme behind the sort of federalist movement, which basically says, let's move the power to the states, and then it'll become impractical, because actually there are a lot of things that are not going to be really effectively subject to governance at the state level. And so it's a way of saying, instead of going to the national government and getting legislation, you'll have to go to each of the 50 states, and you never will, and therefore this area of regulation will die. And, you know, there are areas where we really do need national solutions, and it's one of the great sources of our national strength. And so that sort of demonization of government, the effort to impede the ability of government to govern, I think is something that makes some people somewhat suspicious of the federalism impulse.
Stuart, what do you think?
I agree with that, although it's easy sometimes in the idea of saying let's wipe out the federal regulations so that we'll have the nice states to take care of us to forget the fact that in some states you can't paint your house the color you want because some local commission is saying, hey, this is a historic district. And so regulation can be oppressive whether it's federal or local.
We're talking about the system of federalism in our Constitution. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to go straight to the phones and take some of your calls and questions. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. By the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And by the Overbrook Foundation, supporting catalogchoice.org, a nonprofit service that allows customers to decide which catalogs to receive in the mail. This is NPR.
It's all over now. 21 songs Bruce Springsteen recorded for the album Darkness on the Edge of Town, but didn't include on it, are being released for the first time. On the next Fresh Air, we feature an onstage interview recorded at the Toronto Film Festival with Bruce Springsteen, conducted by actor Edward Norton. Join us.
Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. And with me in the studio this hour, Stuart Taylor of Newsweek and National Journal, Nina Pillard, professor of law at Georgetown University, and Michael Quinn, president and executive director of James Madison's Montpelier. We're going to go to the phones and read some emails now, let our listeners in on our conversation. Here's an email from Mary, and actually we've gotten several emails on this topic. Actually, it was Tom from Cincinnati who sent the email I wanted to read. Sorry. He wrote, I have read that President Washington signed a bill passed by Congress requiring men to buy muskets. If that is true, then the federal government has required citizens to purchase something before. Does anyone know about this? Stuart Taylor, do you?
Yes, it came up before. I was a little stumped at first, and then I went and read the Constitution a little more, which is always worth doing. And there, President Washington did sign that. The power he was apparently exercising at that point was not the power to regulate interstate commerce. It was the power, the war powers, the large, broad war powers, but in particular the power, and I'm quoting from the Constitution, to provide for calling forth the militia to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions, It goes on to say to provide for organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia, etc. Now, how did you arm the militia? In that day and age, you armed the militia by telling everyone you have to have a gun. And therefore, it is true, as that story says, that the federal government has ordered people in the past. Congress has legislated that you have to buy a commercial product. But what is never done until the health care bill, as far as I know, is said, under the power to regulate interstate commerce, we require you to buy a certain product, whether it's health insurance or people, the reductio ad absurdum is everyone's got to go buy a General Motors car to help the economy, et cetera.
Now, here's the email from Mary, who's also writing us about this mandate for to buy health insurance. Mary writes us from Brighton, Michigan. She says, how does requiring us to buy health insurance differ from our having to buy homeowners insurance to get a mortgage or auto insurance to be licensed to drive a car? How is it different?
Well, the most obvious difference is you can always choose not to own a car, not to own a home. What there's no counterpart to that decision in terms of health care. I guess one could say one could choose not to to live, but that's not a meaningful
choice. Plus, I think
those
are all state laws. Mm-hmm. And part of the premise of the whole discussion is, and what part of what they did in the Constitution is they say the general power to legislate, called the police power, but it's not just about police, is in the states. They can require all kinds of things that the federal government cannot require. And I think all the laws that were mentioned, particularly you need to have car insurance, are state laws.
Which really emphasizes the point that I was making before about, you know, some of this opposition is not really opposition to the national government versus the state government doing something. It's opposition to government doing it at all. And so, you know, if this were a mandate as it was in Massachusetts coming from the state level, you know, surely there would be people there who say, you know, get off my back. This is something that's inappropriate for government. And, you know, but the examples, I think, of having to have auto insurance and having to have homeowners insurance, you know, illustrate why it's something that is actually salutary for life in today's society.
But that's a healthy and legitimate debate. You know, what is the purpose of government? As some of our founders have said, the point of government isn't just to secure life. It's to secure the good life. It's the concept of the pursuit of happiness. It's building a society, a community, where life was worth living. And so it really gets to that issue as well.
You know, the distinction between state and national powers is certainly one that Mitt Romney is trying to make. Mitt Romney, as governor of Massachusetts, signed that health care law, but he is now opposing the federal mandate, arguing that it's really something that should be left to the states. I'm sure that's something we'll be hearing about in the next presidential campaign. Let's go to Roy. He's calling us from Rochester, New York. Roy, hi. You're on the Diane Rehm Show.
Yes. Well, I guess you covered a lot. I was wondering about, you know, if there was some sort of intellectual backlog on where the Tea Party was going. And I had I'm not sure if that you've kind of covered some of that, but there's a thing about, you know, the argument of a living constitution. I think some people think, are we talking about the words or are we talking about the men? And I think back to the time when Justice Brandeis was being nominated for the court, and there was a really good battle around that that none of the people currently seem to have had. And they really wanted to have a fight to be appointed. And there were arguments that if Brandeis wasn't appointed, would that show that only people with deep attachment to power and very conservative views were the only people who could be presented to the court? You know, are our selections to the court now becoming particularly narrow? Is it only judges, no longer governors, solicitor generals, politicians?
All right. Well, you're clicking in and out. I'm going to ask Stuart if he could respond to your question.
Well, there's a lot in that question, and responding to all of the pieces of it would take a while, so I'll just respond to one. I think the caller's points out that we've narrowed the class of people, and it long postdates Brandeis. We've narrowed the class of people who get appointed to the Supreme Court. Elena Kagan was the first person appointed to the Supreme Court in some time who had not previously been a federal appellate judge. And she had previously been a law professor and law school dean, which some people might not think of as a great populist improvement on not be on federal judge, governors, senators, et cetera. The Brown versus Board of Education court, famously in 1954, had a lot of big shot politicians on it, and that's changed. And I think the reason it's changed has a lot to do with the polarization of our politics and the difficulty of getting anybody confirmed on the Supreme Court who has a discernible political record.
All right, Rory, thanks very much for your call. Let's talk to Eleanor. She's calling us from Alexandria, Virginia. Eleanor, welcome to the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you. This is really an interesting discussion, but there are a few things I'd like to have more attention to. So I was really pleased to hear the emphasis on states having powers, not rights, because I think rights are something inherent to the individual. They may require a lot of fighting over recognition of the rights, but nevertheless they are individual. And powers are properly conferred, as the Constitution says, to the people. Now, I wanted to really focus in on the use of the Commerce Clause instead of the 14th Amendment in civil rights cases. That's one area I wish you'd talk about. And the other one is, why has there been no public discussion, ongoing if necessary, but no public discussion of the exclusion of women from the 14th Amendment? It makes a huge difference. If you bring, let's say, it makes women very statute dependent, and those statutes can be affirmed or disregarded at will by courts, including the Supreme Court. So you bring a case to a court, and it has no constitutional basis whatsoever if it's a sex discrimination case.
All right, Eleanor, thanks for your call. Nina, what do you think?
Well, actually, Eleanor, the court has interpreted the 14th Amendment to extend to equality for women. It talks about all persons and gives us all equality. And the major cases that the Supreme Court has decided recently, for example, the case admitting women to the Virginia Military Institute was decided under the 14th Amendment.
Nina, you argue that case in the Supreme Court?
I wrote briefs for the United States, but I didn't argue that case. So yes, we do have equality. It comes from a time after the Civil War when the focus was on eradicating slavery and giving equal rights to blacks, but it has also been a very important protection for women. And you're right that some of the more detailed and vital protections are also federal statutory protections, but we do have a constitutional grounding for them.
Eleanor, thanks so much for your call. Let's go to Paul. He's calling us from St. Cloud, Wisconsin. Hi, Paul.
Hey, how y'all doing today?
Good.
I'll try to be brief. I'm wondering why Congress didn't use the Interstate Commerce Clause to regulate the state's insurance authorities. I think there's a lot of argument about the fact that the free market system is not allowed to work because of the confusing mishmash of 50 different states regulating the insurance industry. Thank you.
All right. Thanks very much for your call, Paul.
I think there's a long history to that, and I don't know all of it, so someone can correct me if I get it wrong. Decades passed, early in the 20th century, the Supreme Court held that business insurance was not part of interstate commerce. Now, legislation followed on that. I think the McCarran-Ferguson Act was part of it, where Congress basically relegated the regulation of insurance to the states. Now, as a matter of constitutional power, I don't think there's much doubt today that Congress could regulate the business of insurance and has in some respects, but there is that legacy that's left the status quo of it largely being regulated by states.
Nina, did you want to add anything?
No, I just think Stuart's exactly right. It's more of a political kind of detente and a custom. I think if there were proposals for Congress to regulate that had a lot of political support, they would be constitutionally adequate.
Let's talk to Reed. He's calling us from Havana, Florida. Reed, you're on the Diane Rehm Show. Reed, are you there? Well, I'm sorry we miss. I guess we won't be talking to Reed. Let's go to John, calling us from San Antonio, Texas. John, hi.
Well, hi. I really like what y'all do. There was mention of the fact that the 10th Amendment has been forgotten, and I hadn't known about that. It's illegal federal law at some point made it illegal for people to grow wheat and make bread on their own land. And it, maybe that's changed. I don't know. But it was hardly like, I mean, this is so absurd. If you look at the Jeffersonian, as I understand my history, Jefferson liked the idea of a nation with lots of small producers. It's a stronger nation. Isn't that what we're supposed to be about?
You know, John, interesting. I think Nina was the one who raised the issue of that case. Can you address his question?
Well, it wasn't that it was illegal. There's no prohibition or criminalization. It was whether there could be any regulation at all taking account that the wheat that's grown at home for home consumption is part of the national market. And I think Stuart may remember this better, but I think that was a case about
feeding livestock,
about,
I think. And then whether there were quotas that the federal government had, I'm not sure
right,
how
this
it
was. This was during under the Agricultural Adjustment Act in 1940, and there were efforts to bolster the national price of wheat. And so, you know, this is a whole sort of statutory regime that's no longer in place. So it's absolutely, I mean, I don't want the listeners to get the impression that it's illegal to grow wheat for your own consumption or anything else other than perhaps marijuana for your own consumption on your home property.
Michael.
Well, there's the caller also brought up the Jeffersonian concept of a nation of farmers, a rural nation. And that's certainly one of the issues that has sort of injected itself into the federalism concept, which is that, you know, if you have these virtuous people living off the land, then democracy will work best at the local level. I think the reality, though, is that the world keeps moving forward, and we have to find a way to make our system of federalism, of constitutional powers work, even as the world changes around us.
Stuart.
There was a fascinating Supreme Court case in 2005 that kind of scrambles people's reactions to these things, the Gonzalez versus Raich, and that was the medical marijuana case. The issue in the case was California has a law making it, saying it's okay to grow marijuana at home for your personal medical use. Federal law says, no, it's not, and has said that for a long time. So which trumps? Can Congress make it illegal to grow marijuana at home for your own personal use as a matter of regulating interstate commerce? And the Supreme Court said, yes, Congress can do that. And someone who might have been expected to go the other way, Justice Scalia, who's Mr. Original Meaning to the Constitution, was in the majority and said, yes, Congress can do that. And there's been arguments among scholars why he did that.
I'm Susan Page of USA Today, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Well, you know, we actually have gotten some emails about this difference of law between federal and state governments when it comes to marijuana. Zach is one of the people who's written us. He says, does the federal government have a constitutional right to overlook those state laws and enforce its own laws? And is that settled now, Nina?
I would emphasize the point that Michael made earlier, that the government doesn't have rights, it has powers. But yes, one of the things that one of the implications of the court's decision in the Raich case that Stuart was talking about is that, yes, the national government does have the authority to render it criminal to grow marijuana for one's own consumption, even where a state or a locality says, we actually think that should be permitted. So you see, and I just wanted to sort of highlight one of the themes that had come up a little bit earlier, which is, I think Stuart had suggested, that there actually are sort of some political flip-flops on these federalist issues. There are issues in which people more on the sort of progressive end of this spectrum favor strong state power. There are, states are the source of some of the strongest consumer protection laws, personal injury laws, and there it's the conservatives who say, oh, no, that's something that should be regulated at the national level, and the national legislation on those issues should preempt any state efforts to go further or deal with those questions differently.
Now, Nina just talked about federalist flip-flops when it comes to these issues, when it comes to advocates. How about courts? Do we have signs, Stuart, that the Roberts Court has a different or distinctive attitude sort toward some of these federalist issues compared to previous courts?
It's not clear that John Roberts, the Chief Justice, is as strong as, for example, Clarence Thomas or Scalia, for that matter, as a states' rights guy. We'll find out, maybe, when health insurance gets there. But there have been some important splits among conservatives on the court. But in general, conservatives on the court, and I think as Nina was indicating, like conservatives elsewhere, are a lot fonder of state of federal power to override states on matters of commerce when it's state litigation generating activity, when it's a state law that says you can sue a drug company because you think their drug hurts you, even though it complied with federal regulations. On things like that, the sides tend to flip-flop.
Nina, we'll give you the last word.
Another exception to that doesn't have to do with litigation is the Defense of Marriage Act, where the conservatives said national government can define what marriage is. The states that are doing different things and allowing same-sex marriage should be, those laws should be ousted or not given interstate effect.
Nina Pillard, Stuart Taylor, Michael Quinn, thank you all for joining us this hour on the Diane Rehm Show.
Thanks so much, Susan.
I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane. She'll be back later this week, we hope. Thanks for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org, and we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.